Welcome, everyone, to the 19th session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I will be your host. Today, Dr. Eben Alexander and Karen Newell will be teaching on the brain's role in filtering conscious awareness. They're broadcasting live from Charlottesville, Virginia, while the Sounds True team and I are here in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now, it's my honor to introduce you to Dr. Eben Alexander and Karen Newell. Eben Alexander III, MD, is a renowned academic neurosurgeon. After decades as a physician and teacher at Harvard Medical School, a transcendental near-death experience, or NDE, during a week-long coma from an inexplicable brain infection, changed his perceptions of reality, offering crucial keys to the understanding of human consciousness. He spent the last 8 years since this NDE reconciling his rich spiritual experience with contemporary physics and cosmology. Dr. Alexander has been a guest on the Dr. Oz Show, the Oprah Winfrey Show, and many other national and international media programs. He's written two best-selling books, Proof of Heaven and The Map of Heaven. Karen Newell is an innovator in the emerging field of brainwave entrainment, audio meditation, and she's the co-founder of Sacred Acoustics. She teaches others how to engage consciousness from within in order to connect to inner guidance, creative inspiration, wellness, and intuition. She's found that direct experience is crucial to fully understanding the bigger picture of humanity's existence. At international workshops presented with Dr. Alexander, Karen demonstrates the key practices of consciousness exploration, heart awareness, intention, maintaining neutrality, emotional management, and cultivating internal knowing. Welcome, Eben and Karen.
Well, thank you so much for having us, Christy. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Me too.
And so I'll be talking for the first 40 minutes or so, and then Karen will come in and finish off, and then we'll open it up to question and answer. So it's very interesting, this whole path of discovery that we seem to be on around the brain and mind and the nature of consciousness. Now, of course, most people basically think that the whole mind-body discussion is something that only occurs up in ivory towers and academic circles, and yet the implications of the mind-body discussion have tremendous power over how we understand the nature of our very existence. And this is something that we touched on a little bit in my first book, Proof of Heaven, expanded on a bit in the second book, The Map of Heaven, but Karen and I are just finishing up the manuscript for a third book that we think will really help the world to get on board with this. And the material of that third book, which is due out in October of this year, that book is entitled Living in a Mindful Universe, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Heart of Consciousness. And we're going to discuss some of the concepts that will be brought out in that third book today. And it really is all about that mind-body discussion. Now, those who know my history will realize that I spent more than 20 years in academic neurosurgery, thought I had some understanding of how brain, mind, and consciousness work, and then back in November 2008, I was very suddenly and inexplicably thrown into a deep coma over just a few hours from a severe gram-negative bacterial meningoencephalitis. That's probably the worst kind of meningitis you can have. It's highly fatal, even in treated modalities. And to me, it offered a tremendous lesson in the nature of reality. But the price I paid for that was 1 week spent deep in coma, a coma from which my doctors promised my family by the end of the week that I had no chance of recovering from, and then coming back to this world. And when I came back to this world, all of my memories of life before coma, and that includes all my words and language and all my memories of being Evan Alexander as a human in this universe, every bit of that was gone. All I remembered when I woke up from my coma was that extraordinary spiritual odyssey that I had been on. And in fact, my words and language came back over hours and days, my childhood memories over weeks, all of my life memories, plus all my semantic knowledge of physics, chemistry, neuroscience, everything I'd learned in all those decades studying the brain as a neurosurgeon, all of that came back over about 8 weeks. And that part is a tremendous mystery to me and to all the doctors who took care of me, because when you look through the medical literature, this is not what happens to someone who spent that long period in coma due to bacterial meningitis. And of course, the most amazing thing about it to me, especially as my knowledge came back to me about brain-mind consciousness and I had to reflect my experience deep in coma, is I came to realize that our conventional neuroscience would very clearly state that no one that sick with that illness should have any experience at all and should have no memory of it. So I was haunted by the fact that I had these ultra-real experiences, far too real to be real, deep in coma, and all at a time when my neocortex, which our modern conventional neuroscience would tell you is absolutely essential for providing any kind of detailed conscious awareness, my doctors knew fully well, they had all the evidence from neurologic exams and from my scans, that in fact my neocortex had been rendered completely useless. It had full thickness destruction. This was a very major problem in trying to explain my experience. So for my doctors, the big mystery was, wow, how in the world did this complete recovery over about 2 months even occur? And of course for me, the even deeper mystery beyond that one was, how in the world did I have this rich, robust experience that seemed to be so indelibly imprinted in my memory? And in fact, those memories are as sharp today as they were 9 years ago when I first had the experience. Now, all of that is really another way of saying that the physical brain is not the producer of consciousness at all. And of course, that had been my old worldview, was that scientific materialism. And so in recovering from my illness and in trying to put the pieces back together with my fellow physicians and all, what I really came to realize was our models of brain, mind, and consciousness and this thinking that the brain produces consciousness is completely wrong. And of course, what you're really talking about there is a philosophical position known as physicalism or materialism, which is the position that postulates that the only stuff that exists in the universe is physical stuff. Now, of course, our brain and mind are very good at presenting us with that kind of evidence. They fool us into believing that, you know, we exist in this world with all of these other things around us. And yet, really, all that any human being has ever experienced is the inside of their own consciousness. And this is something that we go into great detail in our upcoming book. But obviously, I want to give you kind of a shorter version of that today to kind of help get to it, because in fact, this kind of understanding runs very deep and is really at the core of all of the evolution of neuroscientific understanding of the mind-body question. And really, this gets into the heart of related fields such as quantum physics and the whole measurement paradox in quantum physics, which can only be explained by having a big enough worldview as to understand all this. Now, another thing it's important to point out that I came to realize in the weeks and months after my coma and years and my study of all this is all of the evidence for what's called non-local consciousness. That is, that phenomena like telepathy, remote viewing, out-of-body experiences, what's called presentiment, where our autonomic nervous system responds to some stimulus before it appears, precognition, where we have some kind of cognitive knowledge of something, of an event or relationship before it happens in time. and also past life memories in children indicative of reincarnation. These are all very powerful and proven realities of the nature of consciousness that completely defy the simplistic brain creates consciousness model. And so this is really where the world is headed today, the world of the neuroscience of consciousness, of philosophy of mind. Every bit of that is working towards a deeper understanding of these relationships. And the first thing that really I would say gets rejected is that model that I worshipped all of my life of materialist science, of a conventional science, that tries to postulate that all that exists is the physical, and that the physical brain creates what in our conventional science we often refer to as that illusion of consciousness. And that illusion is the fact, from a materialist scientific viewpoint, if you just say the physical is all that exists, then what you're looking at is the physical brain and all of the material substance of that brain, all the electrons and protons and the atoms, molecules making up the cells of the brain. And we're looking at it all as basically physical and chemical reactions and electrochemical interactions that give us an illusion of consciousness. But from the materialist scientific viewpoint, it's all nothing more than those physical reactions. So, for example, if you're trying to entertain notions of free will, you can throw them out the window, because purely materialist view of brain creates consciousness, where all of our thoughts are nothing more than chemical reactions in the brain, obviously that doesn't support these other phenomena of non-local consciousness. It certainly doesn't support the notion that I had in my prior thinking, and that was really devastated through the empirical evidence presented to me by my robust, far too real to be real conscious experience that happened deep in coma. Now, it turns out it's not just my experience that provides this evidence. There are millions of similar experiences out there of near death, shared death experiences. For those who don't know, shared death experiences are identical to near death experiences, except they happen in people who are basically physiologically pretty normal. That is, they happen to bystanders, people at the bedside, say, of someone who was dying. Or they could happen 3,000 miles away if, for example, one's parent passes over, makes that transition. In the process, sometimes their soul makes it known to the souls of loved ones, even though they may be at a great distance. And this, of course, is the kind of story that we hear over and over again when we're presenting our stories to the world, because those kind of stories of after-death communications, of deathbed visions and all that, are extremely common. And there's really a much better way to try and explain them than our materialist science, which tries to basically claim that they're all hallucinations and have no basis in reality. Well, I think the millions and millions of people who have undergone spiritually transformative experiences around this world would beg to differ with that simplistic and false interpretation of the data. As most of them report, that realm is much more real than this realm. This is more dreamlike by comparison. So we're just trying to come to a much deeper understanding of this relationship between brain, mind, and consciousness. And one thing that I would put out there immediately that comes to the rescue, that will certainly be a major focus in our book, Living in a Mindful Universe, out in October of this year, is that notion of the filter theory. That is, that consciousness is primordial in the universe. In fact, I would say the entire observable physical universe emerges out of consciousness. All the way back to the Big Bang and beyond is something emergent from consciousness itself. And this is really a very powerful concept. It's certainly not my idea. This came with the brilliant minds of people like William James, the psychologist who was so proliferative in investigating human psyche back in the late 19th and early 20th century, but also brilliant thinkers from the early 20th century that were compatriots of William James, people like Henri Bergson in France, F.C.S. Schiller in Germany, Aldous Huxley later wrote about this kind of filter theory notion. And really, it's a very powerful concept. Frederick W.H. Myers, also a brilliant thinker back there, who published in the early 20th century his all of his evidence, more than 1,000 cases, suggestive of the survival of human personality after bodily death. So this is really about a greatly expanded worldview that has far more power to try and help us come to some understanding of the nature of reality. So whereas the conventional view that I harbored before my coma, that is that the physical brain creates consciousness, well, the main problem with harboring such thinking is that you immediately run into a wall. There is not a neuroscientist or philosopher of mind on earth who can follow that phrase, a brain creates consciousness, with any kind of phrase explaining any potential mechanism. We really have absolutely zero ideas of how that might work. But in fact, in clinical neuroscience, there are robust examples that prove to us the physical brain does not create consciousness at all. The first example I'd like to list, which is something that I did mention in my first book, Proof of Heaven, is a phenomenon called terminal lucidity. Terminal lucidity occurs when you have elderly, demented patients, often those with Alzheimer's. They could have spent weeks or months getting into a very demented state where they might not have uttered a meaningful word for a month or more. And yet as they approach death, they have these episodes of terminal lucidity, which are like oases of great clarity, thought, reflection, where all their cognitive and memory capabilities come back to them. They can be very communicative with those around them at the bedside, often at a time when they see souls of departed loved ones who were there to escort them over. And then that's the end. That's when they leave this world. And of course, those in hospice, nurses who are frequently there at the bedside of those who are dying, can attest to this thousands of times over. It's a very common observation. Now, the other clinical observation I'd like to point out that completely debunks the false notion that the physical brain creates consciousness out of purely physical matter are all those examples of what are called acquired savant or idiot savant syndromes. And this is generally where people with some kind of injury to the brain, some kind of damage to the physical brain, whether it be a head injury, a stroke, autism, or what have you, often manifest superhuman mental capacities, the ability of prodigious feats of memory, for example, cases where people can read a phone book, one page per second, go through 100 pages or so, and then on questioning minutes later, they can return any phone number associated with any name of the many tens of thousands they may have just looked at, just briefly glancing through. Likewise, some people after head injury have been able to calculate pi to thousands of digits in their head, an ability they did not have before. I had one patient, a 19-year-old boy, struck in the head with a baseball who had an epidural hematoma, was lapsing into coma. Luckily, we rushed him to the operating room, got the epidural out very quickly, and he had a very good recovery. And on his second follow-up visit with me, he said, "Doc, maybe you can explain something to me that I can do that I can never do before my coma. Do you have a map?" And I said, "Why, yes." Pulled out a map, showed it to him for about 4 or 5 seconds. He said, "Okay, you can put that away." And then he started to draw that map from the center out. And he did it in perfect detail. And of course, for me, the big question is, how in the world did that happen? And that's what he asked me. Why was it that before my brain injury, I could never do anything like this, and now I have this perfect graphic memory? And it all came after brain damage. Well, I don't really have an answer to that, other than to say it provides very strong evidence that filter theory makes a lot more sense than the production model. And when you realize that we're conscious in spite of our brain, that consciousness is fundamental and is only allowed in through the filtering mechanism of the brain, that's when you start to realize that going within can have tremendous power. That old saying, "the answers lie within us all," is a fundamental part of the message that Karen and I promote. I have used the sounds of sacred acoustics many a time to return to those realms that I visited 9 years ago during my deep coma journey. In fact, I've come to greatly expand on my relationship with that realm through this kind of meditation. And those who want to learn more will hear more in just a few minutes as Karen Newell shares more information about sacred acoustics and those tones and how they are widely available and what their use is. I was first attracted to these kind of differential frequency of brain entrainment tones back in about in early 2011 when I was first beginning to realize just how important investigation of consciousness was to my journey. That of course, if I was going to come to any kind of deeper understanding of the nature of consciousness, I would have to explore it myself, to go deeply within. And that's when I first encountered this concept of using slightly different frequencies in tones presented to the two ears. And in doing so, we are able to then kind of manipulate a circuit in the lower brainstem. And that is something that Karen is going to be discussing in much more detail. But it has offered a tremendous capacity for me to invigorate and develop a very active relationship with those realms that I discussed in Proof of Heaven that I visited in my near-death experience, and to use these for all of my own growth, creativity, guidance, health, every bit of it. The benefits are really endless to what we can get out of all this. Now, I'm a little sorry we don't have our slides available for this particular presentation. I'm sorry we had some technical difficulties with that, because I was going to go into a third category of scientific evidence beyond terminal lucidity and the acquired savant syndromes, and that has to do with some of the recent literature in medical literature assessing the brain physiology and pharmacology associated with certain psychedelic drug states and hallucinatory states, specifically referring here to papers by Robin Carhart Harris that came out first in 2012 from Imperial College in London, where they looked at psilocybin and, to their utter shock and amazement, found that the people with the most robust mental experiences on these psychedelic drugs actually had the greatest shutdown of their physical brain. Now, of course, the reason this got my attention was because it perfectly mirrored my situation in my NDE, where destroying my neocortex paradoxically led to this great enhancement of conscious awareness and perception. How could that be? It completely defied that production model of neuroscience. Well, likewise, this finding in the psychedelic studies, beginning with that 2012 paper with psilocybin, was then followed by another paper out of a group in Brazil looking at ayahuasca. And then more recently, in 2016, another paper from Robin Carhart Harris and team at Imperial College in London, this time looking at LSD, and this time also using not only the BOLD signal of functional MRI, which is a way of measuring oxygen extraction, and it's kind of a proxy for neuronal activity, but in fact, this newer paper also used magnetoencephalography, which is a much more kind of powerful technique in some ways for evaluating neuronal activity. And they just confirmed yet again the profound findings of those earlier papers, which basically said the more profound mental experiences, ego dissolution, hallucinatory experiences, etc., that were encountered by these patients on these particular substances were correlated with the greatest inactivation of the main junctional regions of the brain. I mean, this is really shocking. I remember when that first paper came out in 2012, Christoph Koch, who was a renowned neuroscientist from Seattle, put a blog posting in Scientific American about how shocking it was that under the influence of such drugs, you actually show the brain shutting down in activity. It completely counters the notion of materialist science that the brain produces consciousness. So this is a really deep mystery that I think demands far more explanation in this repeated studies, and that is, of course, what I was going to show in these slides. People can who want to follow up more closely with that can go to my website, ebenalexander.com. and look back at some of my earlier blog postings from about 6 months ago, where I wrote a blog posting that addressed exactly that specific issue. The fact that these various papers looking at fMRI and looking at magnetoencephalography just encountered a tremendous kind of conflicts if you're trying to explain it all as based in the brain producing consciousness. So I think it's important to point out that this kind of growth in scientific understanding does have a major kind of footprint. Those who are interested can learn much more about it. And the kind of places I would send you to learn more about it, I would begin with that beautiful work that comes out of the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia from Edward Kelly, Bruce Grayson, Jim Tucker, and other colleagues there. And that is that fantastic book, Irreducible Mind, Toward a Psychology for the 21st Century. And that book was published, I believe, in 2007. It's listed on evanalexander.com. I have an extensive reading list, and that is right at the top of that reading list. Now, the second book along these same lines that I would strongly recommend to people is from the same group, really. It's the lead editor there is Ed Kelly, and he makes it very clear in the second book, which is more of a theoretical work, the basis of, you know, how this kind of notion of filter theory is so empowering to us in coming to a greater understanding of the nature of the mind-brain relationship and what that means for all of us. And that second book, which came out in the year 2015, is entitled Beyond Physicalism, Toward Reconciliation of Science and Spirituality. So I think for those who believe that this is somehow a battle between science and religion, you know, about the nature of these experiences, the nature of consciousness, how to interpret it at all, I would say it's not a battle between science and religion at all. In fact, there are many scientists who are far along this pathway of much deeper understanding that rejects the false simplicities and errors of the materialist thinking that the brain creates consciousness. This filter theory really opens some tremendous doors to deeper understanding. And that's where I think it is such a crucial thing to get at. And getting deep into conscious awareness is our best way of discovering this. We can all come to know that we are far more than our physical bodies, far more than just our thoughts, just limited to these physical incarnations, and we are also not limited to a birth-to-death cycle. I think this is a crucial part of this. As I said, in my own coma journey, it was very clear to me, especially my core experience, that reincarnation is absolutely essential. You know, what I had believed from my religious upbringing over all those years about one incarnation, then eternal heaven or hell, made absolutely zero sense to me based on all the spiritual lessons of my journey. And one of the most crucial realizations on first coming back to this world was trying to reconcile that infinitely loving and powerful deity, that force of love and healing that so many who've had near-death experiences and other spiritually transformative experiences talk about, that force, to me, there was no way to reconcile it with the tragedies and hardships in our world, the apparent kind of darkness and evil, without recognizing how reincarnation opened up to a much richer interpretation of that infinitely healing and loving force. And of course, each and every one of us is gifted through this much grander understanding of the mind-body relationship and what this kind of investigation into the true nature of consciousness opens up to us in terms of human potential. This is where it gets very exciting and where I hope that the book that Karen and I are writing now will help to wake this world up to this, but it's really about a far richer understanding of our powers as human beings, as sentient beings, and realizing that by acknowledging that the little voice in our head, you know, the little thoughts in our head are not our consciousness at all. That little voice is so deeply tied to our ego. The ego's main tools are really fear and anxiety. And the more we can come to realize, I love how Michael Singer puts it in his book, The Untethered Soul, how that those thoughts, that voice in our head, the voice of our ego, is little more than an annoying roommate. And I think this is a beautiful way to look at it, because those thoughts are not who we are. And our egoic notion of self is not who we are. We can come to know this through going within, through meditation. And this is why Karen and I are such major proponents of meditation and going within. Even though we consider these as sound journeys and other kind of adventures into conscious awareness that go far beyond kind of the simplistic little sleepyhood that might be associated with notions of this limited consciousness. So it's really a tremendous lesson to go within and open those floodgates, because if you realize that filter theory makes much more sense than that production model that physical brain is creating consciousness, then you can realize why going within has so much power. And especially as you come to realize that no human being has ever witnessed anything other than the inside of their own consciousness. This is another major point we'll be making in that book coming out in October, but it has to do with what we call the supreme illusion, which is all of the out there, all of the world out there as it's presented to us, our brain and mind can fool us into believing we are experiencing directly. But in fact, that's not the case. We only experience the information patterns as they're constructed together within our nervous systems, and it presents to us this beautiful replica of the world out there, but it's all an internal construct. And we can only begin to get beyond the supreme illusion by acknowledging it and realizing how much it kind of fools us through so much of our lives into believing a certain situation exists, which is not really true. We are not separate from the universe at all. And in so many ways, this mental experience that we have is very much like one of a hologram. And this also brings up another beautiful book that I read early on after recovering from coma that helped me deeply in this kind of mission. That was a book by Michael Talbot, written in 1991. It's called The Holographic Universe, and he does a beautiful job in that book of pointing out how basically our mental model of the universe is very much a hologram. That in a hologram, all the elements of it, the parts, are reflective of the whole and vice versa. So in a very real sense, to talk about parts of a hologram can be very misleading. I would say, in general, that's true of our kind of reductive materialist approach in science. The very fact that we separate parts of this world out, isolate them in our kind of linguistic system and our scientific methodology, but that very notion of separation in itself is misleading. We are one with the hologram of the entire universe, is another way of looking at it. That's the picture that was kind of portrayed in Michael Talbot's beautiful book. He first put out the mind as a hologram and all that a human experiences, and then he points out how, based on the David Bohm interpretation of the measurement paradox in quantum physics, how you could start looking at the implicate and explicate order of this universe and realize that, in fact, the universe itself is also very much a hologram that is self-reflective between the whole and the parts. And this, of course, is where it got very interesting, because Michael Talbot's brilliant book then merged those holograms together. And I think that's a very good way of looking at this, to realize that we are truly one with the universe. This is where so much of the emerging understanding of this filter theory of universal mind, of collective mind, the collective consciousness and unconscious, all of that is a concept that, when combined with filter theory, can make a position such as metaphysical idealism so much more palatable. And that's a philosophical position which basically puts mind in the driver's seat and says that consciousness is fundamental in this universe. In fact, that's what quantum physicists have been trying to tell us for decades. And yet it's very slow, even for the scientific community, to wake up to the truest realities of the implications of quantum physics for this world. And so that's where I think we find ourselves here in 2017 in trying to make sense of this mind-body discussion, and where it's all headed is to some very exciting ground indeed. But it first and foremost involves a complete rejection of that materialist paradigm, and that the physical is all that exists, and in fact entertains much more productively a notion of metaphysical or ontological idealism, where in fact that objective observer, the self-awareness the universe has for itself, is in fact what each and every sentient being experiences in existing. And so in very large sense, the evolution of all of consciousness, as Teilhard de Chardin portrayed in his monumental works and writings in the mid-20th century, this evolution of consciousness is something that occurs with the evolving understanding of each and every one of us as a sentient being, understanding the rules that govern this universe and our very existence in it. But there really is no separation. And the false boundaries of self, the boundaries of the ego, are what are kind of misleading. They are kind of a false flag of sorts. And this is about awakening to a much deeper understanding of our oneness with the universe. And all of it is emerging from this kind of study of consciousness and our deeper understanding of the mind-brain relationship. Now, that mind-body discussion has been going on for more than 100 generations of human beings, at least 2,400 years into the past, back to the times of Plato and Aristotle. But we are finally starting to make some actual progress. And what I would say is this progress is very much about a synthesis of science and spirituality in a very deep and real sense. But again, as I said earlier, this is not about science versus religion or science versus spirituality, but a much deeper acknowledgement that the material world is in many ways illusory and emerges completely out of mind. And this is where all of our conventional neuroscience and philosophy of mind is headed, to a much richer world, but one that will demand a far deeper kind of investigation and understanding, because we're no longer in that simple little sandbox of reductive materialism where you simply explain the workings of the physical world around us and ignore consciousness and pretend that you have some kind of theory of everything. Well, I hope that most of you realize that any kind of theory of everything must include a far more robust explanation of consciousness and how the whole apparent physical universe emerges out of consciousness before we can consider it anything close to any kind of theory of everything. So I think with that, what I would like to do is tell you, I imagine those who've heard me before and maybe hearing me talk today, you can kind of imagine this neurosurgeon going through the near-death experience that I went through and the tremendous challenge it presented to me in trying to come up with an understanding of the nature of reality. And yes, it did. And for a long time after that, I was stuck in my head as a neurosurgeon, brain, mind, consciousness, defaulting to my old worldview, realizing that, of course, unconditional love had infinite power to heal. That was one of the most fundamental lessons of my journey. Yet how to put that into scientific terms. And all of that started going in the right direction in November 2011. Because at that point, I had the great fortune to encounter my life partner, Karen Newell, who is here with me now. And Karen was the one who was wise enough to realize that I was on a pathway of discovery, but the key missing element had to do with my realizing this was all about a heart consciousness and about a oneness with the universe that, in fact, she had been working her whole life towards understanding much more deeply. So without further ado, what I would like to do is introduce you to my best half and life partner, Karen Newell.
Thank you, Eben. Yes, when we first met in November 2011, I knew that Eben had had a near-death experience. Of course, this was well before Proof of Heaven came out. He didn't even have an agent yet, but I knew he'd had a near-death experience. I had encountered other people practices, and I thought, well, let's see what he learned. So I said, I knew that people learned very important, often very profound spiritual lessons on their journeys, and I asked him, what did you learn on your near-death experience? And he said, the brain doesn't create consciousness. And I thought, huh, I was a little confused, and I said, well, why would anyone think that it does? And of course, this was a shock to Eben because he came up in this scientific materialist viewpoint that there was no other option for in his mind. And I had a kind of a different view going on, and I absolutely was not in that materialist mindset. And this all happened because I was really interested in understanding the purpose of our existence. And the more I would read all kinds of different material, the more I saw that science was very limited because it was only concerned about what was happening in the physical world. But when I would read other texts, say the Kabbalah, theosophy texts, Rudolf Steiner's work, people like that, I would read those texts and realize, oh my gosh, no, there's way more than the physical world. I had figured this out long ago. But the way to really understand this is not through reading. Reading about these concepts will only get you so far. You know, our brains are very powerful calculating tools and analysis tools, and we think they're quite important, and they are. We can consider all kinds of different ideas and think about them from our armchairs very, authoritatively, as some people do. But the real key is experience. The experience of that consciousness that Eben felt during his near-death experience was what turned him around completely. And many people have such experiences. In fact, we theorize that every religion on earth has arisen from someone's personal spiritual journey where they came back with information to share with the world. And this happens all the time. But what we do in our Western society is ignore it. We've been taught that spiritual lessons are not as important as knowing how the physical world works and how can we understand the physical world. So one way to really experience consciousness is through the practice of meditation. And this was something that I tried early on and failed at. I thought that meditation was incredibly challenging. I was a very accomplished information technology director and project manager. I was used to planning very complex projects over long lengths of time. And my mind was constantly doing such planning. And of course, that's our analytical brain at work. But with meditation, we want to make that stop. And this is where it can be very challenging for people like myself and others in our Western world. You know, we hear about Buddhist monks from Tibet who, after 10,000 hours of meditation, they are able to be considered expert meditators. And in the West, we just don't have that kind of time to devote. We don't have that sort of lineage and tradition to even focus on that. Now, what's really interesting about those Buddhist monks is when they were tested here with our Western scientific measurement tools, the act of meditating for such long lengths of time actually changed the structure of the brain through a process known as neuroplasticity. But as I said, I didn't have 10,000 hours, and I would sit down to meditate and I would say, okay, I'm going to focus on my breath or maybe a phrase like a mantra, and it didn't work. My mind would just continuously make lists and make plans, and I got very frustrated until I found a very useful tool, in particular sounds. Now, sounds like gongs or tuning forks or crystal bowls or brass bowls, they make this kind of wavering sound like wah, 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 and it's very mesmerizing. And when I would listen to sounds like this, I found that my mind would start to quiet. And this was a very big turning point. Now, the specific type of sound that really helped me get past this block was something called brainwave entrainment technology, which many people know as a phenomenon called binaural beats. And the way these work is that, first of all, let me explain that our brain is measured in an electrical signal using an EEG device. And it measures whatever electric signal is coming out of the brain in a cycles per second or hertz. So when someone is in a very deep sleep state or even a coma state, that's the delta state. And that can be measured in 0 to 4 hertz. 4 to 7 hertz is the theta state. The theta state is a very relaxed, very kind of almost a sleep state, but still aware. But lots of people, those Buddhist monks, get into theta states very readily just by using their minds. Now, this is just below the alpha state, which is roughly 7 to 8 hertz up to 12 hertz. And the alpha state is associated with REM sleep, which is what happens when you're dreaming. You go into the REM states. And it's also associated with states of relaxation. Now, beta, 12 to 30 hertz, that's the state we're in when we're walking around, talking, and analyzing. This is the state that we're trying to shut down. That's that annoying roommate that Evan mentioned, which is so handy when we're making our plans and describing complex projects, but not so handy when we're trying to meditate. So that beta state was what we're trying to reduce. Now, gamma is 30 hertz and above, which shows up in very profound states of meditation, and also things like the runner's high. People get into those gamma states. But the state that we're really concerned with is that theta state. The theta state is also known as the hypnagogic state. Now, interestingly, many scientists, even Einstein, used different methods to get into a hypnagogic state, and he would get very bright inspirations during those states. Thomas Edison is another famous person. He's invented probably more inventions than anyone, and he also had a method of getting into that hypnagogic state. Other artists, like Salvador Dali, also would use these kinds of methods. Now, very interestingly, Eben mentioned Jim Tucker at the Division of Perceptual Studies at UVA, who studies past life memories in children. That research shows that children often start to remember their past life memories right when they're falling asleep at night, or maybe first thing in the morning. That's when all of us are in that hypnagogic state naturally every single day. And so all of us can kind of think back, or if you haven't yet, do it tonight. Think, what is this state I'm in as I'm falling asleep? And it can be a very interesting state to get into. Now, our binaural beats can help to put us in these states of awareness. And the way this works is by feeding one signal into one ear, say 100 hertz, and maybe 104 hertz into the other ear. Those are sounds that we can hear, but the brain takes the difference between those two sounds, in this case 4 hertz, and the brain stem, we theorize, translates this into a 4 hertz signal that then entrains the brain into that lower state of awareness. Now, recall that 4 hertz is that border between delta and theta, so this is a very magical state. Now, as I explored this technology, I found that I could get into expanded states more readily. I was able to develop greater intuition, get in touch with inner guidance, set important intentions, release, you know, limited beliefs, and really enhance that neutral observer. And in the process of doing all of this, I ended up meeting someone named Kevin Cossey, and together we started creating our own tones and eventually created the company Sacred Acoustics. And it's that company that manufactures these very particular types of binaural beats that have been found to be very useful. Now, there's all kinds of binaural beats out there on, you can get them on apps, you know, you can put in your specifics. There's all different manufacturers of these different binaural beat recordings. But ours are a little special because I'm sure everyone says that theirs are special, but the way ours are special is the way we combine our carrier frequencies. Those are the frequencies that we feed into the ear that you can actually hear. And those are very precise harmonic formulas that are very often, if not always, inspired by numbers and formulas that are found in nature, such as the Fibonacci sequence, which is found in, you know, pine cones and sunflowers and galaxies. All kinds of different mathematical formulas show up in the cycles of planets and how different structures work with each other and grow. And these are the numbers that we harness in our frequency sets. Now, we also make sure that all of them are combined using harmonic formulas, which has allowed us to eliminate things like white noise or water sounds, which help to mask binaural beats. They're not necessarily pleasant to listen to, but when we combine them with these harmonic formulas, we find they're much more easy to listen to, and they become very powerful. And as Eben said, this has become his favored way of getting into altered states of awareness so that he can revisit those realms that he encountered in his coma journey. Now, another key element for my personal practice was the heart, as Eben said. Now, the heart is not the brain, but the heart, as it happens, may actually be more powerful in some ways than the brain. HeartMath Institute is an organization that has been researching the different elements of the heart for many decades. And what they found is, very interestingly, as compared to the brain, well, first of all, there's an electromagnetic field that is produced by the heart and the brain, but it looks like a torus field. And if you don't know what that is, it's kind of like a donut. So it starts in the middle of your heart and comes, imagine a signal coming out the top of your head, going around your body, and then back in through the bottom of your spine, repeatedly surrounding your entire body like a sphere with a hole in the middle, and your heart is the center of that. So this moves out constantly throughout our day. Now, what they found is this electromagnetic field can be measured, and it moves out several feet from the body. And as it happens, the late Joseph Chilton Pierce, who was a very longtime heart researcher, told me that every time they invent a device that can measure that heart field, we actually reach the maximum limit of the measuring capacity of that device. And so we really don't know for certain how far out that field goes from the heart. But the size of it actually changes based on the emotional state of the person who is being measured. Now, that electromagnetic field, as it happens, is the electric part of that field is 60 times greater in amplitude than the brain, 60 times greater than the brain. The magnetic field is 5,000 times greater in strength than the brain. This is a very powerful electromagnetic field. We thought our brains were more powerful based on all the ideas we come up with. Our hearts, we don't pay as much attention to, but are amazingly powerful. Now, also very interesting is that there's a two-way connection between the heart and the brain. And as it happens, the heart sends more information to the brain than the brain sends to the heart. This counters traditional science, which assumes that the brain is in charge of the body and actually sends signals to the heart to keep it beating and all of its autonomic functions. But as it happens, the heart sends information to the brain. Now, I encountered this in another school of thought, which tells us that thoughts can be considered as electric and emotions can be considered as magnetic. So if our emotional state affects the size of our heart field and our thoughts are electric and our emotions are magnetic, we can manage that field very consciously if we start to pay attention. Now, once we start managing that field, all kinds of interesting things can happen. Once you start putting awareness on the heart in different ways, I took a heart rhythm meditation course, which actually has you start to match your breathing patterns with the beating of the heart. And HeartMath has a similar technique where you match your breathing patterns to the feeling of your heart. It's actually very similar. And when you do this, you actually become more coherent. And coherency means that you're just more smooth. You're less stressful. Your autonomic system that goes into high alert in a stressful situation is calmer. And so becoming more coherent is something that would benefit all of us, whether it's the ability to garner more direct intuitive states, or whether it's, you know, getting into a more relaxed state and lowering stress in order to affect your health and your healing response. There's many, many reasons why one would want to get into these states. But what's really fascinating is that one person's heart signal can affect another person. And so think about this. If your heart field is affecting people around you, I personally want to take responsibility for that and not affect people negatively who are around me. And so keeping my heart in a very kind of pure state and not one of anger or stress or greed or upsetness actually helps more than just me. It helps the people around me. Not only can one person's heart affect another person's heart, it can infect another person's brain waves. And so as one person increases their coherence, they actually increase the coherence in people around them, even if those people aren't even aware that it's taking place. That's some amazing power that each of us has. And the more I've become aware of this, the more it has helped me in my personal growth. So the thing is, the more you increase your own coherence, the more you become sensitive to the electromagnetic signals that are coming to you from others. And so, you know, when we talk about non-local consciousness and how are we picking up information, it may very well be somewhat related to that electromagnetic field. Now, Eben and I discussed this very frequently, and he would say, well, the electromagnetic field is still something in the physical world, and we are more than that, and I would wholeheartedly agree. But it's very useful to have something in the physical world to visualize as being part of this, as playing a role. And the more I visualize my heart waves in that Taurus field going out, seeking information, bringing it back to me, and then sending it to my brain, the brain actually then responds to the information being gathered by the heart and analyzes it or assigns different theories of why you're feeling a certain way. But the really most important thing is to pay attention to that heart feeling without any analysis at all. The more neutral we can become when we get into these states of awareness, the more valuable our meditative practice can be. So occasionally what happens when you start to put attention on the heart in various ways is that you start to have emotional reactions. And at first, this can be very annoying. You can think, oh, it's not working, I'm being distracted. But actually, the emotions can be your food. They can be your triggers for learning very important things. And so when you get into these states and emotions start to be triggered, consider that this is your heart's way of letting you know of something that you stored there, maybe from an emotional trauma many years earlier. And the advice when this occurs is to just allow yourself to feel it. Don't worry about how the brain is going to analyze. The best way to get through releasing an emotional trauma is to first trigger it and then allow yourself to re-experience the feeling, but not necessarily the analysis of it. Now, we can apply these kinds of theories to many things. One thing we discuss in our workshops and also in our upcoming book is how to harness intention. And the way we do that is by thinking of something that we want to have and assigning a word to it, one word, keep it very simple. Let's just say success, if you have a project you're working on. But not only think the word success, imagine what it would actually feel like if you were already successful. And by creating that feeling of success in your body through your emotions and your thoughts, you start to feel it viscerally through your whole body. We all react to different kinds of words in different ways. So in this practice, it's very important to pick a word that resonates with you and not with someone else. And so the more that we can really focus on our thoughts and emotions and how they can benefit not only our physical bodies and accessing, intuitive states and spiritual guidance, but affect the people around us. The more that more of us do this and focus on putting positive thoughts and emotions into our energy systems, the more the world will change, because people have a tendency to just match the energy of who they're around. And I don't know about any of you listening, but I would much rather be around people who are coherent, who are calm, who are centered, and each of us can take the responsibility to do that for ourselves. So with that, I'd like to now turn it back to Christy, our moderator, and accept any questions any of you may have.
Thanks so much to you both. We definitely have a lot of questions. And I'd also like to take this opportunity to invite our viewers to submit any questions if and as they arise for you. You can do so by typing them into the field that's right below this video. So I'd like to start with a question about your own personal practice. Given all of the research and the latest findings in this area of how we can deepen our consciousness, I wonder if, Eben, if you could start first, since you mentioned that you had a very strong religious upbringing. How has your experience in NDE affected your own daily practice?
Well, I would say that my experience in NDE completely shifted everything in my life. My own religious beliefs, I had grown up in a Methodist church, had wanted to believe, in an afterlife and God, power, prayer, although in my decades as a neurosurgeon, I had greater difficulty trying to envision how conscious awareness could survive bodily death. And then, of course, as people who've read Proof of Heaven will realize, in the year 2000, I went through an event that was kind of a dark night of the soul that led to 8 years of staunch agnosticism before my coma. And so everything got shifted completely in my coma experience, and that includes a tremendous resurrection in my belief in the power of an infinite source of love at the core of all that is, but minus many of the attributes that I would say are kind of thrown on by Orthodox religion that didn't make any sense. And that would include notions of, say, one incarnation, then eternal heaven or hell. The very notion of an eternity in hell made zero sense. So that had to be thrown out completely. Reincarnation was also something that was certainly not part of my prior religious beliefs, and yet my NDE showed me very clearly how that had to be part of the bigger package. There was no way to understand any of this. And really, I'd say the biggest value of it all is this flip in the worldview. When you realize the brain is not the producer of consciousness, so that going within your consciousness is not some limited little exercise confined in, within the boundaries of your skull, but in fact, going within is a way of getting out into that universal mind and infinite consciousness of this entire universe. So that's where the real power has come, is that real appreciation for the value of going within. Karen, would you like to add?
I thought they asked about your personal practice.
Well, my personal practice is to meditate every day, and I do that for an hour or two every day, and more if I can. But it's really, I've come to realize how much more each and every one of us is in this world, and how much more power we have over our own lives, over our creativity, guidance, inner relationships with others. And going within, for me, is by far the best way to kind of organize and streamline and prioritize that kind of living of this life. So I would say that the benefits of going within and meditation and what I gain from that are tremendous in terms of guiding this life and keeping me in a position of health, and also in guiding all of my choices in how I live this life.
And my personal practice is not so much these days, just because of how busy we are, doing a regular meditative practice, but what I do really is an ongoing, every day, every hour kind of monitoring of my system, of paying attention to my thoughts and emotions constantly, and the vibration that I'm putting out, as I was describing in my talk. This takes effort, but after you start to pay attention more and more and keep yourself in those states more consistently, it becomes a more autonomic system, just like breathing. And that's my focus now, is to bring those kinds of expanded states into my actual waking awareness as I go throughout the day.
And sort of an abiding in that presence, is that right?
Yeah, I guess you would call it a kind of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. Craig writes, Dr. Alexander, the annoying roommate in my head won't let me get past the idea that this is all magical thinking or an isolated incident that happened to you or a select set of people who might be predisposed to this kind of experience. How can a hardcore skeptic learn to soften their resistance to these findings?
Well, the best way to do that is to expand your worldview. In fact, I would say that in all the possible situations involving the relationship between brain and mind, and just to point out to people, that whole spectrum of possibilities in the mind-body discussion begins on one end at materialism, at the brain creates consciousness end, and then extends through its entire range of possible dualisms. That would be of various interrelationships of mind and brain, but in a dualism, you're not trying to claim that one of those is absolutely subservient to the other. So duality positions are all the various mixes of brain and mind that could exist. And then at the far end of the spectrum there, as far from the conventional kind of scientific view as you can get, is the position of pure metaphysical idealism or ontological idealism, where consciousness is fundamental and everything else in this universe emerges out of consciousness. And it's in that tremendous theater of understanding of the mind-body discussion that I would say the first position that is thrown out by the true open-minded skeptic is that position of pure materialism, where you're trying somehow to cram all of phenomenological experience into the physical workings of the brain. And especially when you realize, as I pointed out during my talk, that non-local consciousness is the way this world works, that things like telepathy, remote viewing, out-of-body experiences, precognition, presentiment, past life memories in children, indicative of reincarnation, etc., all those phenomena have a basis in reality. So it's the only way to truly start to understand any of this is by enlarging our kind of theater of operations to a grander possibility for understanding. And I would say that in that world, and this is something that we go into in much detail in that third book, in Living in a Mindful Universe, it comes out in October, we make it clear why this bigger theater of operations actually opens to a richer understanding of these kind of experiences. I mean, the experiences are out there by the millions. This is not just Eben Alexander's little experience or Anita Morjani or someone else who had an NDE. The experiences are out there literally by the tens of thousands on the internet. And according to Gallup polls and other lines of evidence, we can surmise that millions of people have had these extraordinary experiences. So that, I think, is one of the most important facts to make about this. We're not talking about the occasional isolated experience that might be reported in a best-selling book. We're talking about things that have happened to the majority of people living in this world. And that's what requires explanation. And that is where, once you come to acknowledge, as opposed to our conventional medical or scientific approach, which is to deny these and call them all hallucinations, well, in fact, there's far more to it than that. And that's where I think this world is really opening up to the possibilities. But you really have to take the big view. This is not just, well, am I here to decide whether or not one particular NDE actually occurred or not, and consider it in isolation and pretend that there aren't these other, you know, millions of cases out there. We're really talking about addressing the preponderance of human experience here and not simply dissing all these experiences and throwing them away because they don't fit the conventional materialist model.
Eben, do you find that given all of these new openings from this research and from countless experiences that we might be witnessing some sort of evolution in the possibility of human existence?
I would say we are on the verge of the greatest revolution in human thought in all of recorded history. That is what...
We're not on the verge, we're in the middle of it.
Is actually occurring. In fact, I would say within a decade or so, there will not be any single self-respecting kind of scientifically minded person on Earth who will doubt the reality of the fundamental nature of consciousness, the reality of the afterlife, the fact that reincarnation is absolutely real. I mean, these are all facts that are emerging on us from all the evidence that have, to, in many ways, been denied by our kind of the bully pulpit of our conventional science, where that same science has absolutely no explanation whatsoever for the phenomena of consciousness and its relationship to the brain. So really what we're seeing here is a tremendously refreshing kind of eye-opening view of the reality of these kinds of experiences, but it is one that necessitates a far grander recognition of the nature of this universe and of our place in it.
Karen, Rachel writes, in regards to the way our heart fields affect others and vice versa, how can we be safe from being affected by others' negative heart fields, especially when those we love or have close relationships with have such strong negative heart fields?
That is an excellent question. And the bottom line is, the only heart field you have any management ability of is your own. And by focusing on your own heart, think about the fact that you can also influence those people. Flip that concern of, oh, how can I be safe? You can be safe just by deciding to put your own powerful, positive thoughts and emotions into your heart field. And the more you do that, the more the people around you really have no choice but to get out of the way or their hearts will start to change. But the key is there. Never, ever, ever think that you can tell someone how they need to change. It always has to be you that you focus on. And I don't think there's any concern about safety necessarily. You certainly, you know, we all know when we go into work, let's say, and that person who constantly complains about traffic and the weather comes into the office, we all feel that kind of energy shift. That's what we're talking about. And so you can reinforce your own heart field to resist such effects. And it can be done. I've done it myself, and it takes practice, but it can be done.
Dr. Alexander, Ann asks, is it possible that the deathbed visions of deceased loved ones are simply electrical stimulation of memory centers of the brain as the neural system shuts down?
Well, I would say, given the vast kind of spectrum of possible experiences, the answer is absolutely no. I mean, you start hearing of stories that are just so shocking. I'll give you a very quick example. There was a woman I heard from maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, who had was having a minimal procedure done where all she needed was a little whiff anesthesia to put her down for 15 minutes, a little kind of GYN thing done in an office. Well, in her case, she ended up having some complications from it and ended up with some airway problems and then ended up being comatose for about 4 days. And then she had a recovery from it that was quite complete. And in this process, what happened was she had an experience deep in her coma that to her was very profound. One of the most amazing things was in that coma, she encountered one of her workmates, a guy named Ralph. Now, it turns out Ralph was well known in the workplace because he was always very negative, never smiled, was always just horribly kind of bleak and despondent about everything. But when she saw him in this journey, he was elated. He was happy. He was just absolutely smiling on top of the world. And of course, that really caught her attention, and she brought it back in the midst of everything else that happened to her in this journey. But as the friends assembled around her on that day four when she was first coming out of it all, and she was recounting her stories, they said, oh, well, didn't you hear? Ralph died the day you went into coma. Now, that kind of thing, when you hear over and over again stories like that, you start to realize that there's something much more profound profound going on. For one thing, so many of the people that see a soul of a departed loved one on these journeys often don't realize at the time that that loved one has died. They only find out later that that loved one has actually died. Now, how would any kind of electrical sputtering of the dying brain know that kind of information? It turns out when you flip it and look at these the other way, you find way too much evidence that they cannot be simply the sputtering electrical activity in a dying brain.
This one comes from Julie and is addressed to you both. Dr. Alexander and Karen, can you offer thoughts about Reiki and other energy healing modalities? Have you had experience with energy healing? And if so, what part did neuroscience training play in the results?
Well, I'll start with that. Yes, I have experienced energy healing. I'm one of those people who doesn't have a lot of health problems per se to work on. So my particular approach with energy healing was to learn it myself. And in the process of learning it myself, I found that working with animals was a much preferred modality for me. I found when I learned Reiki and did it on humans, it made me just feel not very good. And as I was learning about the heart at the same time in that field, that's what I surmised was going on. But very interestingly, when I would do healing touch for animals and on dogs, for example, that didn't happen. And what that made me realize is that animals don't have the same kind of stuff that humans have. You know, we think that we're superior with our linguistic brains, but somehow they seem to stay wide open in their heart fields. And it's very interesting. Touching them and feeling their energy is much more appealing, at least for me. Now, in terms of energy healing and neuroscience, I think I'll have to hand that over to Eben. Did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the only thing I would add, I mean, I've had my own personal experiences with things like energy healing and all that have impressed me that there's a lot to it. I would say that these emerging models in neuroscience that have a far grander view of the workings of the universe, that is like the filter theory, that consciousness is primordial, all those efforts dovetail beautifully into a deeper understanding of things like Reiki and energy healing and the power of prayer. So I think we're opening up to incredible vistas in terms of healing and our understanding of healing, and a lot of it will really acknowledge the incredible power that we have to heal ourselves, each and every one of us, as we come to realize that our consciousness and our free will can actually interact with our physical being in very strong fashion. You know, the placebo effect has been around for a very long time, and it's widely recognized in the medical world to be responsible for about 30% of healing. That is, 30% of healing can be accomplished just by the patient believing that they're going to get better. I've seen some people who would argue that the number should be much higher than that. In fact, some people argue that basically all of healing depends foremost on that kind of spiritual mental component of being able to manifest free will in the form of healing. So in that sense, I would say that this newer understanding of consciousness and evolving neuroscience that goes along with it opens the door richly to much more powerful modes of healing in those kind of subtle energy and prayer modalities.
Eben, can you say a little bit more about the filter theory and how we might avail ourselves of its resources or energy?
Well, from my point of view, the filter itself is probably closely related to the neocortex. So whereas the production model would say, well, the human neocortex is crucial to our production of consciousness, that's the most powerful calculator in the brain, I would say, well, actually, that is the neocortex is the source of the veiling function that allows for those kind of rich expansions of conscious awareness and mental capability, like I mentioned earlier in the acquired savant and in the terminal lucidity aspects of my talk. So I think that really that's a huge part of our understanding is where that kind of opens the door to much greater possibilities of our free will to influence our physical state.
This one comes from Winston. He writes, I had a shared death experience 11 years ago when my best friend's mother transitioned. I was never close to my friend's mom, but now that I hear you explain it, I know the experience was real. What was happening in my brain or consciousness in that moment?
What was happening in the consciousness was the connection with the consciousness of the friend's mother in her transition. There's a tremendous amount of energy around birth and death, around those transitions. And so that's why things like shared death experiences are so stunning and remarkable. And I encounter them a lot out in the world. I would say for every 20 or so near-death experiences, I have somebody give me a really mind-blowing shared death experiences where they were perfectly healthy and normal at the time. But essentially what was happening there is you were living through a demonstration of the connectedness of souls, and that that connection goes far beyond any simplistic connection within the material world, but is one that is much more hosted in that spiritual realm that we go to in near-death experiences or shared death experiences, but also can choose to experience through meditation. This is why I often tell people you don't have to wait till you die or almost die to come to know all that I know about these relationships. You can do it in a focused, cultivated fashion through meditation, through going within and coming to recognize that connection with that infinite eternal world that you are a part of.
And I just wanted to add, there's actually an organization called Shared Crossing Initiative run by William Peters in Santa Barbara, California. He actually teaches people how to engender a shared death experience, and he's getting rather remarkable early results. So that's another resource people might be interested in.
Thank you, Karen. And this next question is for you, Karen. Comes from Matthew, who writes, Karen, how does sound healing relate to hypnosis, and how can I use it to consciously help me shift limiting beliefs and my self-sabotage?
Great question. Well, hypnosis is actually very similar to brainwave entrainment in that hypnosis is also a way to achieve a hypnagogic state. There's many ways to do that, and one of them is through a hypnotic trance or just kind of guidance, someone guiding you into a relaxed state. There's also self-hypnosis tools. And really, brain entrainment technology is another way to get yourself self-hypnotized, I guess. We don't really use that word, but it's a very similar state. And so hypnosis is very related, except that you have a guide. Now, how do you work on your limiting beliefs? Well, first of all, you have to notice, you have to know what they are. You kind of identify. So I'll just use one, you know, I'm unattractive. We'll use one like that. I'm unattractive. And, you know, you don't think you can attract a relationship or something. And so what you would do is find yourself throughout the day noticing yourself telling yourself that thought. And at first you won't notice. And it's very useful to get into a hypnagogic state using sound technology or whatever you want to use. Not all sound technology, just so you know, not all sound gets you into a hypnagogic state. It's just particular sounds that we've been discussing. But when you get into those states of awareness, kind of lean back into your space and a particular problem where you're thinking that you have a blockage, allow that problem to kind of arise when you're in that state. And that's where you can kind of recognize what those limiting beliefs are. And you can see things from a more neutral state. Getting practice with that neutral observer inside is very useful. Now, if you try this just once and just go into that state and it doesn't happen, try again. This is, you know, those monks took 10,000 hours. I took many, 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 many hours before I got successful, not nearly 10,000, but it does take practice. Now, once you identify those thoughts, as I said, notice yourself having those thoughts during the day and replace them with another thought. Sylvan Mind Control, which is a course that I took many years ago, taught a useful tool, and that is when you notice yourself having a thought you don't want to have, cancel, cancel. You say that in your mind, cancel, cancel. This is just one technique. There's many ways to do this, but stop yourself from having that thought. Once you start noticing consciously that you're having those thoughts, change them and replace them with an opposite thought or a thought that is, you know, less non-beneficial. This is the practice I was referring to that I perform on a constant basis. And what happens is, even in the heat of a conflict, once you get practiced at this, even in the heat of a conflict, say with another person, your neutral observer kind of kicks in a separate part of you and says, oh my gosh, now I understand why they're saying what they're saying. Now I know what I need to say to get them to shift, to get this energy to shift. It's very useful to start paying attention to those automatic thoughts, especially those limiting beliefs. So great question.
It looks like we have time for quite possibly one more question. And I'd like to go with one that comes from Jill and is, I'd like to see how both of you respond to it. If these experiences are so valuable, why does the neocortex seem to filter them out so strongly?
I'll start, and Eben and I answer this question a lot. Some people might ask that in a different way, which is, why do we have hardships? Why do we forget? Why do we not know the real truth? And I think that speaks to the same question. Why does the neocortex play this role? And I would say that it plays this role because we want it to. There's a whole other school of thought that says we actually plan our lives, plan the events that are going to happen. And often hardships are those very strong catalysts for spiritual growth. And so we wonder, why do we have this? Why do we have to not know? And the reason is we don't want to know. We want to come into this challenge of life and not realize that we planned it so that we can really see how will we behave in this situation. Now, I know Eben has a lot more to say on that. I just wanted to introduce that concept.
Yes, that's a beautiful question. And, you know, it kind of gets at that fundamental question of why don't we just have a heavenly realm where we all sit around and play harps on a cloud all day long and have that be it? Obviously, that is not kind of the intention of what all of this is about. This existence is what I would call soul school. In fact, I would say the entire universe exists so that sentient beings, which are out there by the billions in many different forms, can live these lives where we're temporarily kind of dumbed down. We don't have the knowledge that our higher soul has that we regain when we reunite with that higher soul, either at the time of physical death or during an NDE or during deep spiritually transformative meditative experiences. But it really is all about coming to see that the imperfections in life are the reason we're here, the hardships and difficulties. It's recovering those memories of connectedness with the one, with all others, that we're never disconnected. It's really that kind of lesson that we're here to learn. And if we came in here with the knowledge of our higher soul, we would not be suitably involved. We wouldn't have skin in the game. So that's why it's so important to point out that so much of this is our kind of emotional reality that we live through. So we feel the joys and the blisses of love and connection, but we also feel the pain and suffering of loss when we lose loved ones and have a terminal diagnosis and all those big challenges in life. But what my journey showed me so clearly is those are the gifts. Those milestones and challenges in life, whether it be illness or injury, are all about how we grow. And we grow by learning and teaching and recovering this knowing of oneness and of connectedness, recovering this knowing of our divine nature. And this is all about the discovery that we are to go through now. And it's really getting beyond, away from any kind of false notions of self and separation. So this really is a journey of leaving the ego far behind. But it's really having that emotional buy-in and skin in the game of feeling, you know, all of the emotions of human incarnation that help to drive our learning and understanding. And I would say a big part of that is kind of the other side of the coin is that programmed forgetting. You know, the fact, for example, when you consider all the scientific study of past life memories in children indicative of reincarnation, you realize that it's very common for children to remember past lives, but you can only recover them between ages 2 and 6. And outside of that, you really have a very profound process of kind of a programmed forgetting, that we're not meant to have all that knowledge, you know, that we have between lives and from our higher soul's perspective. And so that is what gives us skin in the game and allows us to grow in the soul school.
Well, Eben, we're going to leave it on that note. My goodness, you just cracked open a door to a whole nother session.
Well, there is a lot out there. This is kind of about the nature of everything that is.
And this is all covered in our upcoming book. So,
yeah, that'll be out in October of 2017, Living in a Mindful Universe.
Thank you so very much, Eben Alexander and Karen Newell, for helping us remember who we came here to be.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been great.
Thank you.
Wonderful. This concludes our 19th of 20 live sessions in the Neuroscience Training Summit. Our gratitude once again for Dr. Eben Alexander and Karen Newell for this excellent presentation. I'd also like to thank all of you, our viewers, for your participation and the great questions that you submitted. So we're down to the last day of this Neuroscience Training Summit, and I do hope you'll be able to join us for the final session this evening. And once again, the recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. And if you wish, you also have the opportunity to purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. At Sounds True, we've wanted to make the Neuroscience Training Summit as accessible as possible, but we understand that even with 24-hour access to the most recent broadcasts, you might have missed some of the sessions that you really wanted to attend. The good news is that you can own the entire downloadable library of 30 hours of teachings and practices, if you choose. Over the last week and a half, we've taken in lots of detailed neuroscientific information, and much of it might warrant repeat listening just to help digest the implications of it all. Each session, as you've seen just now, it's included deep trainings, dialogue, tools, resources, and practices, and it can get a little overwhelming. And to embody it all, that's something else entirely. If this material resonates with you and you feel moved to own the downloadable library of these sessions, I invite you to click the button on this page. On each of the sessions I've hosted, I've bookended them by telling you what an honor and pleasure it is to introduce you to these teachers, because it truly has been. In fact, it's been a tremendous experience not only to co-host this Neuroscience Training Summit with Tammy Simon, but to have connected with and learned something life-changing from each presenter and from some of the most deeply heartfelt questions that you've submitted as viewers. If that's not an honor, I don't know what is. Again, our sincerest gratitude goes out to all of you, our presenters, for distilling leading-edge insights that gratitude extends to our viewers as well. Please join us for our final live session with John Arden, and that's going to take place 5.5 hours from now, March 29th, 2017, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples, thanking you so very much for joining us. SoundsTrue.com, many voices, one journey.